From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. At a news conference this morning, Boulder Police Chief Maris Herold read the names of the 10 victims killed by a gunman who opened fire at a King Soopers supermarket in Colorado yesterday afternoon. A police officer is among the dead.
Denny Strong, 20 years old. Nevin Stadinsky, 23. Ricky Odds, 25. Trelona Barkanovyak, 49. Suzanne Fountain, 59. Terry Liker, 51. Officer Eric Talley, 51. Kevin Mahoney, 61. Lynn Murray, 62. Jody Waters, 65. Our hearts go out to all the victims killed during this senseless act of violence.
The suspect was injured and is in police custody, and federal, state, and local law enforcement officials are working together to investigate the crime. This shooting comes less than a week after a gunman killed 8 people at 3 massage parlors in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And Colorado has seen a number of other horrific mass shootings, including at Columbine High School in 1999 and at a movie theater in Aurora in 2012. Joining us now with the latest on this one is Natalia Navarro, reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Natalia, what more did officials say today about the latest shooting?
Hi, Callum. Police did not give us much new information about what exactly happened inside the King Soopers grocery store yesterday, but we do know the shooting started around 2:40 on Monday afternoon. Boulder police received a call about a man with a rifle. When police arrived, they immediately engaged with the alleged shooter and got employees and customers out of the store in waves.
Natalia, we heard the chief read the names of the victims, including a Boulder police officer, Eric Talley. He was the first officer responding to the scene. What more can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Officer Talley was 51 years old, and he worked at the Boulder Police Department since 2010. His father told a local TV station that he leaves behind 7 children. His police chief, Maris Herold, said this morning that he was a kind man who cared about the community, that he was willing to die to protect it. Herold also said that she had Talley and his family in her office only a few weeks ago to give him an award for his work.
Wow. And I know it was a career change for him later in life, too, so committed to the work. One other theme at the news conference today was the close cooperation between local, state, and federal law enforcement. They together released the name of the suspect. We're not going to repeat it here so as not to contribute to his fame, but what else did they disclose about him?
He's a 21-year-old resident of a nearby Denver suburb called Arvada. Officers haven't released any information about a possible motive. The FBI special agent in charge says it's too early in the investigation to make any conclusions about that. They did say that they are confident that he was the only person involved in the attack. And last we heard, the suspect was being held at a hospital after being treated for a wound to his leg. The Boulder County District Attorney says he'll be booked into county jail after his medical treatment is finished. And we know he's facing 10 counts of first-degree murder.
You know, Natalia, I mean, the city of Boulder is clearly shaken, but I'm wondering just more broadly about the whole state of Colorado, which has seen a number of shootings in the past couple decades. We mentioned a couple earlier, but there's also been some at churches, schools, a Planned Parenthood, a Walmart. I mean, how is the state responding today?
Yeah, overall, naturally, people are really upset and shaken. Many people, including myself, have been getting texts from family and friends across the country checking in to see if we're all right. The death toll is really just astounding for Boulder. It exceeds the number of murders in the last 9 years combined. So it's really unusual. But as a whole, mass shootings have become, you know, all too common in the state. So people are feeling pretty numb.
Yeah, numb and still shaken at the same time. Natalia Navarro from Colorado Public Radio, thank you for bringing us the latest on the ground there.
Thank you for having me.
We've been seeing the images of migrants crossing the southern border as the Biden administration comes up with its own immigration policies. Unaccompanied children are not being turned away, nor are some parents with younger children. But many border crossers are being sent back home, and the situation is straining resources and leading to some confusion among migrants. Joining us now is Molly Hennessy Fisk, the Houston Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Molly, you've been on both sides of the border over the last few days. Can you describe what it's like there right now?
So It depends on what time of day and what stretch of the Rio Grande River you're on, because here in Texas, it's a very windy river with a lot of brush along it. So you have to get down into the brush and see where people are coming across. Some people swim or walk across, but most that I've seen have been coming across in rafts with smugglers, getting off on the other side and turning themselves in.
What are migrants telling you about their journeys and their understanding of the shifting rules here in the United States?
So there's also different groups of migrants. There are the new arrivals, many of them from Central America, who say that they've come for economic reasons, some of them because they had lost work or couldn't work in the countries they came from. Many are from Northern Triangle countries. That's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. There were also hurricanes there during the past year. Plus, we've got the pandemic, which is affecting the economies there, too. And then also there's crime, specifically gangs. I talked to some young men, a boy who was 12 years old, who came to avoid being recruited or forced to join a gang. But then you also have migrants in Mexico who have been waiting for years in the Remain in Mexico program. They had applied for asylum in the U.S. They had asylum cases, and either their cases were closed or they're still open, and they just have not been allowed to enter by the Biden administration.
You're reporting today on the paperwork that migrants are getting if they're allowed to enter the U.S. It's confusing.
Yes, migrants have just like one sheet of paperwork, and it just says, this is not a document to stay in the country legally. It's got their photo and their fingerprint on it, which means that Homeland Security Border Patrol took their biometric information, which is what they told me, but it's not clear what their status is. And they were asking me, and I asked immigration lawyers and also Border Patrol, and we asked the White House at the press conference yesterday, well, what does this mean? Do they have legal status? Can they get on a plane? Because down here on the border at a lot of airports, Border Patrol agents are right there at TSA checking your information. And the lawyers told me that they can take planes, but it's unclear they won't be able to work, whether they can register their kids for school or these sort of, you know, things that people do in their daily life. If they get stopped by police, will police honor that paperwork and realize that they're here legally? And then the bigger question, will they be able to apply for asylum or some other kind of legal way of staying in the country?
You didn't get a satisfactory answer during that press conference that really gave you a sense of that. But did the Biden administration give you any understanding of what they plan to do in the future for those people?
It really isn't clear. So, you know, I said to them, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a reporter, so I can't explain this to you. And I encouraged them to talk to the volunteers at the respite center in McAllen. And I spoke to the director of the respite center, the executive director for Catholic Charities here, Sister Norma Pimentel, and she told me that they do tell them and urge them to get in touch with immigration officials in the cities where they're going. One of the lawyers I talked to said she's putting together like a Know Your Rights presentation and is going to be going out to the bus stations where some of the migrants are and some of the shelters to give them more information.
The Biden administration is saying about all of this that they have the situation under control. They want a humane system. This sounds really convoluted. It depends on the honor system. And with the influx of migrants that are coming, I want to know from you, you've been reporting on this for quite some time. From your view, what's working and what's not working? What do you think needs to happen next?
Well, the flow of people does not appear to be stopping from what we see. Specifically families and youth who come without adults. And the issue with young people who come without adults specifically is that they can't be released. They have to be transferred to a shelter and then placed with a family member or another sponsor. And that process takes time. And you need shelter space, which they've been rapidly expanding in recent weeks. But they still don't have enough space, and the extra space they have is running out. So it's not clear if this, you know, persists for another month or even a couple of weeks, what they're going to do other than, you know, go to Congress and ask for more money. Or I really don't know what they're going to do, because in the past, what they end up doing is just opening more. Oftentimes, too late after the crowding has gotten really bad. And there have been, issues that arise out of that, health issues for migrants, especially the youngest ones.
Molly Hennessy Fisk is the Houston Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She and her photographer, Carolyn Cole, have been in McAllen, Texas, reporting on the influx of migrants at the U.S. southern border. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you taking stock lately of the meaning of your life? If so, you are not alone. You have been writing to us after we asked listeners for reflections looking back on 1 year of this pandemic. And one theme that has really stood out is that many of you are trying to find meaning and gratitude.
My name is Carrie Bartmans, and I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. While the extra family time has been wonderful, my focused tiny life means that other relationships have waned. I hope that soon we will be able to gather and give each other grace for how we made it through the pandemic. We all did the best we could in difficult times.
Hi, my name is Hoku Gilbert, and I'm calling from Kaneohe, Hawaii. I've always been a hopeful person, but the pandemic taught me to not continuously look to the horizon for my hopes and dreams. My gratification comes instead from each day, each moment.
Both Hoku Gilbert and Carrie Bartmans join us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Carrie, I'll start with you. I know it's been a tough year. You have grown children that have been in and out of your house. You care for elderly relatives. You've not been able to go back to work teaching water aerobics. And yet, you describe your life during this past year as both contracting as well as expanding. How so?
Well, I thought when I would be physically constrained to my home and close to home, that I would be bored and lonely. And what I found is that I had time to focus and go deep into things rather than always rushing around. So I had time to talk to my folks. I had time to teach them chair aerobics over Zoom. I had time to reminisce. Life slowed down and allowed me that extra time. And then I took up hobbies and did things that I always wanted to do, like learn canning and sewing to make masks. And for me, it's been a silver lining.
Hoku, it sounds like you can somewhat relate to Carrie. You have a grown daughter in college, and you also take care of an older family member. How has your outlook on life changed and maybe your experience over the last year?
There is a quote from Pico Iyer where he says, "Only by stopping movement can you see where to go." And at least for me, and it sounds like for Carrie, that has been part of the silver lining. And the blessing is that we do tend to spend so much time looking forward and thinking about those plans that we've made. And when we were forced to just slow down, it was wonderful. The things that you see, and yes, there's a lot of anxiety as well, but it has been a chance for me to grow inwardly in terms of what I want, what keeps me content, and what's best for me.
Yeah, that slowing down makes things seem so clear. I completely understand what you're saying, and thank you for sharing that quote. You know, anecdotally in conversations, sometimes people say they don't have room to complain about their situation during this pandemic because there are always others who are doing far worse. How do you both acknowledge the pain and struggle that others who are less fortunate are going through while also making space for yourself to just vent? I'll start with you, Carrie.
Well, I've stayed connected with some girlfriends who are in a similar situation with children at this age, this in-between time where we have parents needing us and grown children needing us. So that has helped. We have our Zoom happy hours that we do, and we try to connect with that. I will say it hasn't been completely easy to do that because some friendships have waned a little bit because people have different acceptance of risk. So some people didn't understand why I was so locked down or you know, it's just difficult to always be on the same page during this pandemic. But you know, they always say during tough times, you find out who your friends really are. And I think we did. I think we found people that we could speak with, and the rest we will take time when we get back to and heal those relationships.
Oh, cool. I have a question for Carrie, because when she mentioned community, one of the things that I found in our little neighborhood is that we've really gotten to know our neighbors better. And the way our neighborhood is formed, people walk their animals in the afternoon, and we kind of knew each other before. But, I mean, we've really gotten close. There are walking groups now that meet every morning. We know everybody's dogs, and we know the what's going on in everybody's lives so much more than we used to. It's wonderful. And we share food and things like that. And I wondered if that was happened in your neighborhood too, Carrie.
I would say that not so much. I live kind of in the city part of Charlotte, and people are moving to Charlotte constantly right now. And I have maybe five houses right around me where we have new neighbors, where, you know, I drop off a little gift of welcome and then take six steps back and with my mask on say hello, but I haven't been able to see their faces or sit down for any length of time. So I feel a little bit like life kept marching on and I need to catch up. So I really do look forward to when we can get to know each other more. You know, the neighbors that I did know well, and we all had kind of a, we call it COVID bubble, of people that were like-minded and were safe, and you could, you know, sit outside and talk with them. But others, you know, you couldn't. So, yeah, I think my community feels a little fractured, and I'm looking forward to bringing it back together or meeting new people.
Mm-hmm.
Hoku, just wondering how your children have come through it, because it's been a different experience for my 20-something children. It's been really tough on them, and I wouldn't want to have been that age going through this.
Yes, I agree. I have one daughter that just turned 21, and she's going to school overseas. So there's already that combined with a whole separate country and their rules and restrictions on COVID as well. She's in her last year of school, and it's really easy to start thinking, you know, this is such a bummer. This wasn't what you anticipated. I realize this is not how you thought it was going to go. But what I have found is that they're pretty resilient. And sometimes if you just lay it out there and say, yeah, this kind of sucks. It's not how you thought it was going to be. But here are still the things that are great about where you're at right now, that she's actually doing okay. She's had a couple of tough times. But overall, I'm amazed at the resiliency of our young people, and that gives me hope as well.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah.
We kind of started this off by talking about how during this time, people are grasping to find meaning in their lives. That is the one thing that is illuminated for themselves during this pandemic, is just their purpose in life.
Well, I found that I rather enjoy the cloistered lifestyle.
Oh, really?
There's so many things now when I get going through my emails in the morning or something, I just like, I don't need to know that. I don't need to worry about that. You know, there's just a lot that I feel like I just toss away and shed every day mentally. And it feels very good to not just spend so much time caught up in things. Start to look at the news feed and go, yeah, no, I don't need to know that.
You know, there's so much going through my head, but the funnier things are like, I used to care a lot more about what I was wearing and makeup and, you know, wearing heels or anything like that. And now I find I really like house slippers. You know, who knew? And just,
I have
some
on right now.
Right, exactly. Like I used to, you know, love to go shop and buy a new outfit. I haven't bought new clothes in months and months and months, and I really don't care right now. Mm. I mean, maybe if I eventually get to go out again soon, hopefully, I'll want something. But it's just the material stuff and the runaround has just, I don't know, I don't care as much anymore. And maybe that's good. Maybe just a feeling of I have what I need. It's reprioritized a lot. in my heart.
Right. Mm-hmm. I try to spend some portion of every day counting my blessings, literally. And there's always a stock group of things that I'm grateful for. And then there are the extras. Somebody, you know, a neighbor brought me a piece of pie today or something like that. But when you spend more time focusing on that, as Carrie said, suddenly a lot of those other things really don't matter. I'm okay. My family's okay. My animals are okay. I'm very grateful for all the blessings that I have. And it's enough.
Mm-hmm. Hoku and Carrie, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your lives with us and teaching us so much. I learned so much just by hearing about your experiences.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Yes, thank you for having us. It's nice to connect even this long distance and talk about the silver linings and the things for which we should be grateful, because there's a lot of it out there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That was Hoku Gilbert of Kaneohe, Hawaii, and Carrie Bartmans of Charlotte, North Carolina, both Here and Now listeners who shared their reflections with us on life during this pandemic.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about what we're watching, listening to, or just trying to figure out, like what concert films you should watch if you miss live music, and great books to read alone or in your book club. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
COVID-19 is killing 20,000 people a week across Europe, and countries are scrambling to deal with the rise in cases. In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel is calling it a new pandemic, and she's extended a lockdown to mid-April. The BBC's Damian McGinnis joins us from Berlin. Damian, besides extending the lockdown, Merkel also announced new restrictions for the upcoming Easter holiday. Now, that's something no one was expecting.
Yeah, they were a real surprise, Callum, because what we saw was after this 11-hour marathon meeting between regional leaders and Chancellor Angela Merkel, Angela Merkel essentially cancelled Easter. So what she said is over 5 days, the country would be completely shut down. And the idea is to really break this rather steep rise in infections we've started seeing over the last few weeks. That's mainly due to the variant that was first spotted in the UK. Now, that makes up the majority of new coronavirus infections. And that's incredibly worrying because, you know, as you correctly pointed out, the government ministers here are calling this almost a new pandemic because the new variant is more infectious. It's more infectious for a longer period of time. And it's also potentially more serious and hospitalises a higher percentage of people. And all that means is that whereas last year Germany had coped relatively well with the pandemic and had a relatively low death rate compared to other similar countries, this year, over the past few months, and particularly because of these new variants, the death rate has really shot up.
Well, I think the new pandemic language, as you say, really sort of underscores the seriousness. I mean, a tamer way to describe it might be a third wave, but we hear the new pandemic language to drive home the seriousness, Damian. And we know that infection rates are rising across Europe more broadly, but what's going on in Germany in particular? I mean, why is the infection rate rising so much there?
Well, here we've never really had a very severe lockdown. And that's really because the infection rates were much lower right throughout the beginning of the pandemic. But then over the last few months, and really since autumn, the infection rate has actually spread right throughout the country. And it has meant that particularly in nursing homes, older people have been affected. The other factor, of course, is the slow vaccination rollout.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that, Damian, because the vaccination rate in Germany is considerably lower than the rate in some other European countries, some of the neighbors right there. So why is the German vaccine rollout so slow?
It's pretty similar to other EU countries, so other countries within the European Union, but it's much lower than the vaccine rollout or the pace of vaccinations in the UK. That's mainly because the UK has decided to not go along with the EU's vaccine procurement programme. The EU was much more hesitant, went in much later, also tried to bargain down pharmaceutical companies because there are, you know, poorer countries and richer countries in the EU. So under pressure from poorer countries within the EU, that did mean that the EU was under pressure to look at pricing. As a result of that, many experts believe that some pharmaceutical companies, such as AstraZeneca, have favoured the UK. AstraZeneca has supplied the UK with all the vaccines it's ordered, but it's only supplied the EU with about 30 to 40% of its orders. So that means that the EU, in comparison to the UK, has a much lower supply. That's the basic fundamental starting problem of all this.
The BBC's Damian McGuinness with us from Berlin. Damian, thank you.
Thank you, Callum. Always a pleasure.
We're about to bring you a conversation with a comedian, but it's not all laughs as the nation confronts yet another mass shooting. Joe Coy has built a hugely successful stand-up career, mining his Filipino heritage with sold-out shows and 3 Netflix specials. But Coy writes in a new memoir called Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo, that growing up as a half-white, half-Filipino kid in the 70s and 80s meant dealing with constant racism. Coy recently joined me on Skype to talk about the book, which is out today, and I began by asking him about what it's like to have his memoir come out now, as last week's shootings in Atlanta and attacks against the elderly have put the spotlight on anti-Asian violence.
You know, it sucks because we have to experience something so horrible and horrific to open up the eyes of so many blind people. And I didn't want to use this situation as a platform to promote the book. You know what I mean? Like, this is something that was very, you know, especially with me, with my mom being a Filipino immigrant, you know, this is something I've experienced firsthand and always had to keep to myself, because you live in a country where it's almost normalized and accepted, almost, where Asian culture tends to be quiet and not really speak up. And now we have a generation of people that are speaking up now and defending and letting our voices be heard. So yeah, I'm with everybody that's doing it right now.
Well, I think you make an important point, but this isn't a promotional thing as much as just noting that in your comedy and in your writing, I think that you approach some really difficult conversations in a very disarming way with humor, right? I mean, you address stereotypes in your comedy. You put your own spin on them. And I do want to give listeners a taste of that if they're not familiar. So here's a bit from one of your Netflix specials where you use a story about your Filipino mom to take on this perception that all Asians look alike. Let's listen.
I look out into the crowd. You can't tell us apart. You can. You know how many Mexicans my mom walks up to and goes, Filipino?
The joke is landing there, Joe. I mean, you're getting the laugh. But as we read in your book, it took a while for you to feel comfortable incorporating your heritage into your comedy. Why were you hesitant for a while?
100%. Well, I mean, it's hard. You know, like what I said earlier, you live in a country where it's normalized. You also have to understand, like, my position where I struggle with identity, right? Like, I got a white father and I got a Filipino mom. They divorced when I'm 10. You know, my dad moves to another state and now I'm latching onto my Filipino side because that's who's raising me. And yeah, the joke is landing, but like, also know the background to that joke. Imagine my mom being an immigrant woman from the Philippines and coming to the States in the 70s. A lot of racial tension between, you know, and seeing a mixed kid is something that wasn't normal yet. You know what I mean? Like, people didn't really see anything like us before. And imagine her just out of the Philippines coming to America. And now she's got to find friends. And I always say this to my son or all these kids now. There was no Facebook. There was no Instagram. There was no findfriends.com, whatever. My mom literally had to build up the courage to walk up to people and ask them what they were. And that's what that joke is. It's like, yeah, it's funny, but it's like, just imagine my mom's struggle at that point.
I know that she and you ultimately did find that community of Filipino immigrants, but it took a while. And you write about the jarring experience of, in your very early years, being on military bases where there were a lot of mixed race children and you fit right in. And then moving to a place where you were the only one in your class who was half Filipino. And it was a difficult experience. And then you say humor was your way to fit in where you initially didn't feel like you fit in. What do you mean by that? How was humor your way in?
humor was my escape, you know? Like, you know, I do another joke where I go, you know, I tell people I'm Filipino and I get the worst compliments. It's like, oh, you're Filipino, I love orange chicken. And like, yeah, huge laughter, and I loved it as well when I did it. But then it's like, imagine being that guy where it's like, I don't even know how to tell people what my culture is, you know? Like that no one can really relate to it and how important it was to me. I had to use humor to try and get who I am as a person out there. You know what I mean? Without being an ambassador. Like when I was growing up, it was always like, you know, I'm Filipino and they're like, oh, what kind of food do you eat? You know, telling people about my culture and talking about my food. And thank God I had humor to back that up because it was easier for me. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say? Because it's hard to explain.
It does make sense. And I love the bit about how you show up to school with your Cool Whip lunchbox that your mom sent you with after you lost your nice lunchbox. And your mother keeps coming up. I mean, she's so central to your comedy. And I want to play a bit where you talk about a time when you were sick as a child. You thought maybe that you had pneumonia. And she prescribes Vicks VapoRub as a cure-all for everything. Let's listen.
There's one time I thought I had pneumonia. I go, Mom, I think I have pneumonia. She goes, I'll put extra Vicks on your body, Joseph. Just rub it everywhere, Joseph. Rub it on the bottom of the foot. And then put a sock on the foot. And then the pneumonia will come out of the foot, Joseph.
So there's the humor there, Joe, but as you were talking earlier about there being a serious undercurrent to it there, you know, we learn in your writing that, you know, this is partly because your mom didn't have money for expensive medical treatments when you were growing up. In fact, there wasn't money for a lot of things, and it made me remember how you write that after doing a lot of begging, your mother did ultimately give in and make room in the budget for HBO, and you write about how HBO became something like a textbook for you. You binged these stand-up specials and studied the comedians, and I wonder if you took that studying so seriously, in part because you knew what a sacrifice it was for your mom to pay for something like HBO.
Yeah, you know what's crazy is just like seeing indirectly how hard my mom worked. Like you said earlier, when you know when she started going to church and started meeting other Filipinos and building that little community of Filipino friends, and then next thing you know, we're renting out the Knights of Columbus Hall next to the church and throwing little Filipino events and seeing my mom get her kids to perform and organizing those events. Like all that stuff was like indirectly embedded in me, you know, just watching how my mom made things happen and, you know, seeing her grind and her hustle. So I took that on and thank God I did, man, because it helped me a lot.
You know, your mom is so central to your comedy, but you mentioned your father earlier as well. And I know, as you said, that at one point he walked out on the family, but you reconciled and he came back into your life later and actually was someone who encouraged you to go into stand up when there were a lot of skeptics.
My dad was like, yeah, man, this is what I want you to do, dude. Do this. Pursue it. This is your dream. Do it. I remember my dad said to me, he goes, don't do what I did. I always wanted to be a pilot. And now look, I'm still dreaming about being a pilot. It was cool to really see him get excited for me pursuing something that I was dreaming about. It was like he was living vicariously through me.
Yeah, he urged you to take your shot, and you have, and it's paid off, of course. But one of the things that's really notable about that is the way that you've made an effort to bring others along with you. You did your most recent Netflix special in Manila, and really, I think you shared the stage as much as you were on there with other comedians who you wanted to promote and give a platform to, because you write in your book about how it was really hard for you to break into comedy, and that a lot of clubs would only book you as part of some kind of theme night. I'm wondering how much you've seen things changed, if you've seen things change, and how important it is for aspiring comics to see people who look like them on stage.
Well, I hope, you know, we start changing even more drastically, because when I was coming up, it was really bad. You know what I mean? Like, I was literally doing theme shows with horrific names, man. Asian Invasion and Slanted Comedy. Like, I'm not even making this up. You can Google it. When I finally got into Netflix and they gave me that second special coming in hot, and then they asked for a third one, and I was just like, I'd really like to showcase Filipino talent. And I know how hard it was for me to get in here, and I just want to provide this one opportunity. You know, I opened up the door and now I want to let others in.
The last thing I'm curious about, Joe, I mean, so much of what you do, I think, is based on interaction with the audience. And we're coming to the 1 year anniversary of a period where we haven't had any of these performances in front of live audiences. So what has this pandemic year been like for you? And are you optimistic about the future?
What I love the most about my job, stand-up comedy, is feeling the fans' energy coming back at me, you know, and there's not a drug in the world that can give you the high that live performance gives me. When I feel them clapping and cheering and I say goodnight and they stand, man, that's everything to me. And I cannot wait to get back on stage and do it again.
Yeah, here's hoping you're able to get back on stage with a live audience very soon. Don't, but in the meantime, we can laugh along.
Don't say hope. I never say hope. And I never say probably, because whenever you say stuff like that, you're almost saying like, well, you know what? If it doesn't, but I hope it does. When I go back on stage, which will be soon, it's going to be a beautiful time. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, this is very Yoda-like, right? Do or do not. There is no try, right? This is,
you are
getting back on the stage. In the meantime, though, we will have to settle for reading your new memoir, which is called Mixed Plate, Chronicles of an All-American Combo. It's a lot of fun and also kind of serious at the same time. Joe Coy, thanks for talking about it with us.
Oh, I love you, man. Thank you so much.
Anyone who has used a dating app knows the drill. You find a match, then comes the online sleuthing to make sure the person you're going out with is actually who they say they are. Well, now Match Group, the parent company of Tinder, is working on a way to help you with those background checks. Tinder is investing in a nonprofit called Garbo, which will provide users a way to see if people they meet on the app have a history of violent crime. Catherine Cosmides is founder and CEO of Garbo and is here to tell us more about it. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Tell us about your company, what it does exactly, and why you think it's necessary.
Yeah. So Garbo is a nonprofit technology startup on a mission to help proactively prevent gender-based violence in the digital age. And, you know, we're just connecting with so many strangers in today's digital world, and we have no way of knowing if they have a history of violence, who we're putting our physical safety in the hands of. And so Garbo is really there to provide access to the information that can help proactively prevent some of these violent crimes from occurring.
Okay, this isn't going to automatically become part of every Tinder user's experience with the app, is it? Who is going to have access to it, and how much will they have to pay to use your service?
Yeah, so it's definitely not ingrained in every Tinder user experience. It's definitely a personal decision to use it, and we believe in personally empowering people to make safety decisions. And in terms of cost, you know, we're definitely still discussing that, but Garbo is a nonprofit for a reason, and we truly believe that public record access should be very, very affordable, if not free.
Okay, so Garbo would provide criminal background checks to users. But that actually is a pretty limited picture of someone, isn't it? You've said you'll just provide information about violent crimes, not things like drug possession or traffic violations. Why did your company make that decision?
Yeah, so we believe that there are three types of violence. There's human-to-human violence, which is obviously our predominant focus. Then there's violence against the state and violence against property. And so we made the decision to not have drug possession charges or crimes on the platform or minor traffic violations, because they've shown in studies to have little to no association with gender-based violence and a ton of association with the racism in the criminal justice system.
You're also withholding personal information that other background check services seem to include, like people's emails or addresses, to prevent stalking. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so we like to call these people search sites stalking as a service, because they provide access to incredibly invasive information like home addresses, email addresses, and phone numbers. Like, the people who are listening, you should look at these sites and see what information is available on them. It's quite dangerous. And you know, it's my personal experience where my abuser used these sites and other digital tools to stalk and harass me. So I'm all too familiar with these types of tools. And Garbo was really inspired by doing something different.
Okay, what about privacy concerns? Tinder says it will not ask for or store users' background check information. But do you anticipate Tinder users will feel uncomfortable knowing they'll likely be investigated just for being on a dating app?
You know, that's the thing about Garbo's background check, is it requires a first name and a phone number. You have to opt in to giving the other party your phone number. by giving the phone number, you're not giving permission necessarily for them to search you, but you are taking that step, and it does enable that person to personally make safety decisions on their own, essentially.
One other issue with background checks is that people with common names can get mixed up. How do you make sure you're not falsely associating someone with a criminal history they don't have? Will there actually be some kind of verification if you're running a huge volume of background checks?
This is a great question and something that we care deeply about. And there are generic names like John Smith or something like that. And so with our system, there has to be a certain percentage, and it's a very high percentage, that we believe this is the right John Smith, essentially. But for names like John Smith, you know, we may require additional information from the user beyond just their first name, phone number, and location. We might start to require their sign. Are they a Gemini? Are they Aquarius? That helps us narrow down the results. Certain pieces of information like that will help alleviate this problem.
Okay, before I let you go, you know Tinder's parent company, Match, also owns other dating sites, Match.com, OkCupid, Hinge are among them. When is this going to be live on Tinder? And are you expecting to roll out this kind of service on other sites too?
Yeah, so we definitely plan to be live on Tinder this year and expand into the other Match Group portfolio companies as soon as possible.
That's Catherine Kosmides. She's founder and CEO of Garbo. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.